Hi, folks. Galen Clavio here. Welcome to a new show on HoopsHD.com, the midweek show. And no, we don't have a better name for it yet. We will be looking for better names for it, however, in the near future. So if you have any suggestions, you can tweet us at HoopsHD.com. But I'm Galen Clavio. Nice to be joining you once again. And the reason we started the midweek show, for those of you who have been following the Bracket Racket for a while, we normally do a two-hour blowout every Sunday night, but we thought this year, you know, there's so much that goes on during the week. I feel like some of the games that happen midweek kind of get lost in the shuffle. So we really needed to emphasize the games that have gone on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, for that matter, and kind of reset things as we head into the weekend. So that's the purpose of this show, to talk about those games, to talk about some of the issues that have popped up as a result of those games, and also look at things that are going to be coming up on Thursday through Sunday so that we can get you folks ready to watch them. So happy to be joining you and looking forward to a good solid hour of college basketball coverage here on Hoops HD. We'll go ahead and check in with our panelists joining us. First off, Kyle Lamb, freshly shorn, joining us on the show. Kyle, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Just in the time you were speaking, though, I've been whistled for three different fouls. We as fans are adjusting to these new rules just as much as the officials and players are.
Yeah, actually, it's funny because I was talking with Samantha Daywig, our sometimes contributor on Hoops HD, and I was like, you have anything you want us to talk about on the show? She's like, you need to talk about all the effing fouls that are going on right now. And that's definitely on the agenda for this evening, and it's something that in the big showcase games that happened yesterday was a big, big element that people can't seem to stop talking about. So we will get to that. David Griggs joining us as well. David, how you doing?
Pretty good.
Good.
It's good to be here on the midweek.
What do you do? I've gotten some email from our fans. What is it that you do when you're not podcasting with Hoops HD? Because I mean, they're curious as to what the life of a basketball expert who's also a puppet happens to entail.
Drinking, lots of drinking.
But you also do that during the podcast, so.
Right. Well, yeah, I do. And before I did this, I was a teen idol, and that was rough too. Because you wake up in the morning and you're on your way to work, and there's 30 teenage girls outside, all screaming, following me around everywhere. So, I gave that up for this.
We appreciate your service. It's a noble sacrifice you've made on our behalf. Thank you.
Yes.
So we've also got Chad Sherwood joining us once again. Chad, how are things on the East Coast this evening?
I'm doing good. Things are pretty good here. I also did want to note that in addition to everything else David Griggs does, we did actually see him in a movie recently, Sharknado.
Yes!
Oh yeah.
How was that, Dave? I mean, that was interesting. How was working with Tara Reid? I've always wanted to do that myself.
Speaking of drinking, yes.
The whole thing is a blur. Yeah. It really is. I mean, there's partying and then there's partying with Tara Reid, and
thank you, Chad. I'd forgotten all about that. We were going to mention that on the last show, and we didn't. We'll have Lee Delvecchio joining us here sometime very soon. He's having some trouble with his computer. So,
Fortunately, is a man who needs no introduction.
Yes, exactly. So, Lee will be joining us here shortly, and we got a lot to talk about. So let's go ahead and just dive right in. And first off, guys, we really need to address the big games that happened yesterday. Obviously, you had Kentucky taking on Michigan State. That was the one that most people were pointing to. A lot of people in basketball, I think, were kind of expecting Michigan State to win that game, and they did. Kentucky came out very tentative, and yet, you know, Michigan State couldn't hold on to the big lead that they had in either the first half or the second half. Kentucky did come back. They tied it at one point late in the game, but Michigan State just a little too strong down the stretch. What did you take out of that game? Let's just start with that one. For both teams, obviously, for both Michigan State and for the Kentucky Wildcats. Let me start with Chad, and we'll move down the line.
Well, okay. Well, first of all, we're not going to talk about how unfair this game was to Kentucky. I think we covered that pretty much on Sunday. But really, I took out of this I was really impressed with Michigan State in that first half. The way they came out, they just came out firing. They built up that huge lead. And I don't know how much that lead was as much Michigan State as much as Kentucky just being what I thought they would be at the beginning of the season here, which is a team that has not been able to gel yet and has not been able to have the time to come together. The fact that Kentucky was able to make that big run in the second half, even though they didn't win the game, I think that shows a lot for this team. And I do think that as we get through the season here, as we get into SEC play, this Kentucky team is just going to get better and better. And I actually was more impressed with Kentucky in a loss than I thought I would be when all was said and done.
And that's something I read from several different folks throughout the course of last night and then again today. David, your thoughts on the game and what you were impressed or not impressed by with either team?
Well, I was impressed, I guess, I thought the first half was rather sloppy, especially by Key. That's typical of any young team, no matter how talented it is. Michigan State opened it up, and for a second, I thought they were just going to open it up and run away with it, but... I was just impressed with the way Kentucky made adjustments and fought back into it. Now, it was November, and there was a lot of Novemberitis going on, I thought. Like, the help defense wasn't good. Kentucky took a lot of forced shots when they could have passed it and got better ones. But again, it's November. And I think that the evidence is there that this is not – I know I picked Kentucky as one of my busts earlier in the year because of the lack of senior leadership, but – despite the loss and despite some of the sloppy play, I think that there's a lot of evidence that they will continue to prove gel and get better. And it really wasn't fair, having to play Michigan State on November 13th. It might be fair to other people, but not to them.
Right. It was interesting, Kyle, obviously, Michigan State.
Bearsman.
Bearsman's here. We'll get to him in a second. But Kyle... obviously, Julius Randle started slow, had a pretty good game, though. 27 points, 13 rebounds. He had 8 turnovers, which is a little bit sketchy, but you might expect that. But, Kentucky, they struggled from the foul line throughout the course of the game. Michigan State got great games out of Appling and Harris, and they got a pretty good game out of Adrian Payne. It was a lot – it felt a lot more balanced, I guess, for Michigan State throughout the course of the contest. And it felt like when Randle was going – Kentucky did very well, and when he wasn't, they seemed to lack court presence. Do you see that as a problem for them moving forward, and what other observations did you have?
Well, first of all, to contradict what the other two have said already, I kind of felt the biggest adjustment was Michigan State's front court being whistled for 15 fouls. Honestly, I felt like that's what got Kentucky back in the game more than anything. Now, I will say this about Kentucky. I'm just from an athletic body standpoint, this is a very impressive team. I mean, they've got, NBA bodies all over the floor. But I think what's going to hurt this team in particular that I've seen is that their backcourt is just not explosive like it's been in the past. The Harrison twins, James Young, these guys are just, kind of spot-up shooters right now, and I don't think they have the kind of a playmaking ability that they've had, with John Wall and Brandon Knight and some of these other guys in the past. And I think that's going to hurt Kentucky a little bit going forward. Now, their bodies, Dakari Johnson and Willie Cauley-Stein and Julius Randle, who I agree, I think Randle was trying a little too hard to make plays, but he is an excellent talent. I do think that those guys are going to win a lot of games, especially against smaller teams. But I think in the bigger games, I feel like Kentucky's biggest problem will be the lack of playmaking from their backcourt, and I think that could catch up to them.
It's something worth noting, I think, that, first off, you mentioned the fouls. I mean, Michigan State was whistled for 27 throughout the course of the game, Kentucky 19. But if you look at the individual production, the biggest struggles for Kentucky seem to come when Dakari Johnson was trying to convert possessions or when Aaron Harrison was trying to convert possessions. And even Randle, he finished with a sub-100 offensive rating, which I was a little surprised by, but you can kind of blame the turnovers for that. I think a lot of the foul situations that you mentioned, this is something that I'm really curious to see how it plays out when these top-level teams play, particularly when we get to conference play, because you know, you get a Michigan State and a Kentucky playing one another, it just ends up being a primary storyline because you have athletes on both of those teams that are going to get to the basket. They're going to have guys' hands on them for the majority of the contest. And, you know, the larger foul issue overall, I don't know if necessarily more fouls are being called across the board, but they are being called in these games with top-level teams. And I almost feel like, you know, you look at the players, you look at their reactions, and they seem to be surprised that they're getting whistled for fouls. I don't know. Does it seem like to anybody else that what we're seeing here is a situation where coaches on these teams are basically sending their players out and saying, look, just go and do what you normally do and make them foul you out of the game?
I think so. I mean, it's been... I knew that there would be an adjustment period, and I was giving it until hopefully the end of the month. I was thinking after Thanksgiving, hopefully by then players will adjust. And I knew we'd also have some unwatchable games, but it's still kind of disappointing just from, you know, a fan appreciation standpoint to see this many fouls called. I mean, they needed to change the game. I think it will be a better game once the players and coaches adjust. But for now, it's just, it's a parade to the free throw line. It's the last 2 minutes of any game that's within 10 points and a team's trying to catch up. It's just foul after foul after foul after foul. I mean, good grief.
There was at one point during the Duke-Kansas game where fouls were called on something like 10 consecutive possessions. It was crazy. It was just unbelievable. I mean, a game like that, two top five teams, I get it. I understand it. But you just hate to see a game like that taken over by whistles.
Lee,
hold on one second. Lee, your microphone is muted. So if you want to unmute your microphone, that way we can get you on. But we can't hear you right now. I think it's interesting because go ahead, David. Finish your thought, please.
Well, to just kind of piggyback on what Kyle said, these are showcase games. These are games where you're trying to, like, engage the public and get people interested in basketball at a time when people really aren't. I mean, in certain parts of the country they are, where you are they are, in Kentucky they are, in North Carolina they are, but for a good deal of the country, these were showcase games, and it might be some of the few games to where people are really paying attention to until the Super Bowl ends, and they get out there and it's unwatchable. It's foul, foul, foul. 10 possessions in a row, and I get it. Like, they're changing the rules. There is an adjustment period, and that's what we're going through. But you hate to see a showcase game for college basketball, I don't know, tainted with so many fouls.
Well, but look, and I guess, and Chad, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. I still believe in the concept of the rules changes that they're trying to put forward. I think they're necessary.
Oh, I do too.
I think that the spirit of the game has kind of has gotten away to a certain degree because it is so physical, and they're just much like there are certain teams that can take advantage of offensive situations that the current rules have. I think there are certain teams that can take advantage of the physical situations that are demanded by the current rules. Or at least the ones that have been called up to this point. I knew there was going to be an adjustment. I have been a little bit surprised at the freak out that everybody's had over the rules, because anybody that was paying attention knew that something like this was likely to happen, especially in the first month of the season.
Well, I've actually found it a little bit interesting that some of these games, maybe not involving the marquee teams whose coaches probably believe they are above these rules, we've seen scoring up. I was watching a game earlier today between Holy Cross and Sacred Heart, which both teams were over 100 by the end of regulation, and the game went double overtime. And that's a game where you're not seeing a lot of the fouls, where you're seeing the coaches have come in, all likelihood have coached these players, listen, we've got to back down, we've got to let them take a shot. And it's actually was a very entertaining game to see the teams running up and down the floor, having open shots, making hoops, and seeing who can score the most points, which is, you know, I guess that was the point of the game when it was invented, was who can score the most points in 40 minutes. So
that was college basketball in the early 90s.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I look back at and granted, I'm biased because I grew up in this era. Kyle did as well. I guess David – well, actually, I think we all did. You know, we all grew up in this era, you know, from about 1982. 81 until about 1994 when the shot clock got dropped from 45 to 35. And, you know, games were regularly in the 70s or 80s. You didn't have the slugfests generally, particularly in the NCAA tournament. I mean, you would have physical games at times, but you know, even with the longer shot clock or prior to 1986 with no shot clock, most games went a significant amount of time went to a significant score. I mean they had decent scoring throughout, and we've lost that over time, and we've blamed a bunch of things on it. And you know, and really, you look at the physicality, you look at the way that that teams have played over the course of the last 10-15 years, and it's very similar to what the NBA went through in kind of the post-Jordan first retirement era, where it went from a league in the 80s where you were scoring 100, 110, 120 points a game in some cases, to a league where you were scoring in the 80s, maybe the 90s, and that was that. And so, you know, I forget who made, there was somebody that wrote a very good article about this, and I apologize because I can't remember who it was, but they made these changes in the NBA, and things opened up, and now the scoring is back up where most people would like to see it. People are not reacting to these rule changes well, though. They're acting like the game is being ruined for them. And, it seems to hit the hardest when you have a game like Michigan State and Kentucky where people, they don't want to see the fouls, but then they also want to see the offense. It's like, guys, you can't have both. You have to have one or the other, I think.
Well, and there will be a point, and I think it's going to happen quickly. And just to be clear on how I feel about this, I supported the rules changes and the points of emphasis. It's just that I knew the adjustment period would suck, and it does in a game like that. Now, again, had they played that game a little later, I think when you get after the, I think after the exempt tournaments is when it's going to sink in, when we get to those December games and those games over Christmas. And by the time we get to conference play, I think it'll just be all forgotten and people will like the game as much or more than they ever did. But, yeah, it's an adjustment period. The way that these guys are used to playing is no longer, I mean, they're trying to change that. And
my only issue, I'm all in favor of what they're trying to do. I'm all in favor of the spirit of the new rules. Here's my only issue. While I will say there will be, we're not going to see 50 fouls a game called the rest of the season. It is going to loosen up a little bit because eventually players are going to back off. Eventually, you know, officials aren't going to call everything because they just get tired of blowing whistles. So you're going to see a little bit of regression from what we're seeing now. My only issue that I'm afraid of, and I've said this all along, is I think that I always said to people, be careful what you wish for, because if the game is ever called like it is in the rule book, everything is technically a foul. If you put your hand on an opponent, it's a foul. And my only problem is I don't like the way the rule is written right now. I have no problem with how it's being enforced, but I don't like how it's written. I'd rather they go to the NBA rule where you can actually hand check so long as you're not pushing an opponent off course. And I think eventually that's what they're going to have to do, because I think this is going to be a little bit too much of an extreme. And if they go to the NBA rule, I think it'll find a delicate balance between what we had before and what we have now.
We've got Lee Delvecchia. There's Todd Beresman standing in for Lee. But I still think Lee is on mute. Lee, can you hear me? I mean, are you there at all?
Yeah, how about now?
Hey, there he is. All right.
I was here the whole time.
You want to chime in on this at all?
Yeah, I respect Dave, but I'm like completely shocked that he's surprised by this. I don't care.
Oh, I'm not. I just don't like it.
Like I'm surprised. It's this. I'm not. I don't care. I'm fine with it. You don't want all the whistle? Don't foul. The officials were asked to do nothing more than enforce the rule book as it existed. And the saddest thing for me is that this is a big change. This is the way it should have been all these years. I am fine with it. If people want fewer fouls, players should stop fouling. That's it. I don't care about the adjustment period. Tough. I would rather go through two tough months than another 10 years of watching 48-45. I couldn't. I'm just upset. If I sound upset, it's because I almost went to Worcester tonight for Holy Cross Sacred Heart, and I missed a hell of a shit, sounds like. Because if, you know, think about it. When was, you know, I mean, college basketball was probably most popular, you could argue, maybe the late 80s, early 90s. I don't think it's because of all the scoring, but it certainly helped. And I don't think we're going to bring back the glory days of having a guy like Vince Carter in college multiple years, but, you know, at least let's make the game more entertaining. And I would rather have 122-118 over 65-63 any day of the week. And, you know, I applaud – I mean, you look at Holy Cross and Sacred Heart. Those are two schools under relatively new coaching staffs, not coaches that have been there for 10 years and refused to change their style. That's where I think you'll see the adjustment start. At these, the majority of schools in Division I where you don't have coaches that have been there 25 years who don't want to change, who don't fear change, realize, you know what, it is the way it is. I have a great job. I'm not going to complain about my lot at a smaller school. If I adjust now, it'll be quicker than adjusting later. And also, the few that will think, I better adjust now because it's year three and we haven't shown a lot of progress, and talking to the two beat writers about how unfair the rules are isn't going to change the graveness of my, you know, my job situation here. So, you know, the adjustment period is as long as the players and coaches want it to be. It will only be long if the players and coaches choose not to adapt. Yeah. It's on them. It's not on the fans. It's not on the game.
Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, I think the next 2 weeks, particularly with the holiday coming up and all these exempt tournaments having championships, a lot of games are going to be on TV featuring a lot of teams that people want to watch. So I'm curious to see what the overall public reaction is to all of this. Anyway, I want to get to that second game, Kansas playing Duke. And while everybody was collectively losing their stuff over Jabari Parker, Kansas went out and won the game. And I forget, Kyle, did someone predict that on the Bracket Racket on Sunday? I can't remember.
Yeah, I want to say it was the cousin of Todd Bearsman.
we've changed that.
That's right. No, but Kansas and and Andrew Wiggins pick up the victory. It was an interesting game, and Kyle, let me get your thoughts on it first. Hold on, I want to get.
I'm sorry, if anyone else is watching Oregon, they'd know why I just screamed in horror. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just saw that too. But no, Kyle, what were your thoughts on that Duke Kansas game?
Well, I will say, and let me do a mea culpa, and congratulations to Galen for calling this, because I was all over Duke-ish before this game, and I was all on Kansas for being overrated. And I tell you, Kansas, not only they proved me wrong, but what's most impressive is they did it really without Andrew Wiggins playing like everybody was hyping him to play. I mean, he actually was not a huge factor in this game. They got tremendous contributions from Mason at the point guard position. You know, Brendan Green was great off the bench. I was very, very impressed with the Kansas backcourt in this game. Embiid, you know, he's still a little work in progress inside, but he's clearly got some ability. Bottom line, this Kansas team showed me, you know, a lot of things that I didn't think that they had before. And I still think Duke is very good, but I have questions about them defensively. Rodney Hood was a no-show for this game. I still think Duke is going to be an explosive team, but they have some issues. But at the same time, I mostly give Kansas credit. I was very impressed.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because, you know, obviously, with Kansas, you're expecting Wiggins to come out and really just play lights out. And he had a very good game overall. I mean, he struggled at first, but he finished with 22 points, 8 rebounds. He was in foul trouble for a lot of that first half, and that gave him problems. But other guys stepped up. Perry Ellis had an excellent game. Frank Mason off the bench had an excellent game. Wayne Selden played well for them. And, you know, for Duke, Jabari Parker, I mean, he had a couple of just magnificent plays, but he was 5 for 11 from 2. He struggled a little bit at times, particularly when Wiggins was on him defensively. I mean, that was kind of the lost plot there in the second half. When Wiggins was defending him, suddenly all those easy looks he was getting in the first half kind of went away, and I thought that was a very interesting development. But Lee, obviously this was a game that I think almost got overshadowed a little bit by the Michigan State-Kentucky game, but I found this game a lot more entertaining than that one.
Yeah, in this game, I mean, yeah, both teams, they were really going up and down the court. I thought this was way better to watch. The crowd was just awesome to see a game with the crowd into it, and obviously you have Jabari Parker from Chicago. But at the end of the game, it's amazing in the society we live in. You could see on Twitter the way it was developing. It was, if Andrew Wiggins didn't come out and drop 50 in the first half, he's not that good. And when it came down to the game being on the line, Wiggins showed why he's one of the best players probably in the country. And, I mean, I just loved that Jabari Parker and Andrew Wiggins both made a play in this game that really will stick in my memory of their very brief college careers. That's all I'm looking for. I don't want to break down their offensive rating. I don't break down that Jabari Parker didn't really shoot very well. I just enjoyed watching the contest. This is what the sport needs. It needs top teams and big buildings with people actually paying attention before March. I refuse to bring the second game of the year when these teams are playing Final Four level teams, anything that could have gone wrong. I mean, it's Parker's second game in his hometown. Yeah. He's got as much pressure on him as any player in college basketball will have this year, other than Andrew Wiggins possibly playing Kentucky in a title game. No player can have the pressure that kid had on him last night, and I thought he delivered. I was just impressed by both teams. I know that's a cop-out, but, you know, Kansas was the team. Nobody really talked about them as a team. It was all about the fact that they have Wiggins, but I mean, I was really impressed by Perry Ellis. I mean, he was awesome last night. Wayne Selden was great. And Frank Mason, you know, he only played 23 minutes but was outstanding. I mean, boy, the free throws really rigged that offensive rating. But, I mean, for me, I'm basically taking away the players I was impressed by. I was impressed by both the top guys. But the guys that don't get any pub on Kansas because of the Andrew Wiggins black hole of attention – Wayne Selden and Perry Ellis, who both been, I mean, Wayne Selden's been a pretty good college player.
Yeah.
And last night, he was big for them in a game where nobody was paying attention to him. Just really growing as a distributor for that team. I was very impressed by Kansas. And, hey, again, I don't know, does Bill Self have to win, like, 18 consecutive Big 12 regular seasons before people realize he's a easy top five coach in the country? Or do we want to just keep only talking about the other three guys who coached last night?
I think we're just going to end up talking about the other three, unfortunately.
Bill Self is on the hot seat. I mean,
every year. Well, I'm going to jump off these games. And Chad and Dave, if you want to jump in on them, that's fine. But I want to move on to some other ones. And, Chad, I want to go to you first. Sure. VCU and Virginia played last night. And this was a game that kind of got buried because this game ended – I think after the Michigan State-Kentucky game had started, it was like early in the second half. This was a hell of a basketball game and just a great finish, like one of the best early season games we've had in a while.
Exciting finish.
Absolutely. It was one of the better games. It was more exciting than either two games in the Champions Classic there, even though that's what probably 90% of the country that was watching basketball was on. I just was impressed, really, with this VCU team as I was going into the season. I think they really, really came up with a huge statement win here. This is a very good Virginia team, a very good defensive team always under Tony Bennett there. And I was concerned with VCU on the fouls. And, you know, this was a 59-56 game. It wasn't a 109-106 game, but I think it was an impressive win for Virginia, just a really good game. And we did not see, at least as far as VCU goes, nearly as many free throws being shot. Only 15 free throws attempted in this game.
Yeah, they didn't.
On their side,
yeah. No, Virginia shot quite a few. Virginia shot 33 and only made 19, which was the ball game. It's also interesting. Kansas against Duke scored a point and a quarter per possession, which is nuts. That's crazy. Virginia scored 0.81 points per possession. If you were looking for your rock fight of the night, this was probably it.
Which is what you would have thought would have happened going in. I was so impressed by VCU. It looked like I'd love to jump on Tony Bennett and Virginia, but I mean, it looked like they were going to lock this up with 3 minutes to go. And then VCU, it's platitude but true. It just doesn't matter. They always find a way, and it's just that's where I think Virginia style kind of kills them, because I can't get mad at them for not making more shots in the last 3 minutes with a big lead, but at the same time, when that game got tight, it didn't feel like Virginia had a chance of making a basket when they had to get one, because they're not geared towards creating offense. And once VCU was slashing through them at the end there, it just felt kind of inevitable. And one of those two teams has medal in big games the last few years, and it ain't Virginia. And I'm just impressed with VCU. I mean, you know, they go in there and they are the favorite, and they are the Goliath in that game, even though the school names, and even though Virginia's really good, and I do think Virginia's really good. And they still pull it out. I'm so impressed by them last night. I was rambling. They were awesome.
Oh, it's fine.
At the end there. And David, it's just, I wonder if that style with the new fouls was going to be an issue, but they can still, look, they made, VCU committed a lot of fouls with the old style, and I admire Shaka Smart for, in a sense, he's not being stubborn like some coaches are with the new rules when they don't change their style. He's just kind of up front been, you know, this is our style. We're going to adjust a little bit. We're probably going to commit even more fouls. We're just going to have to learn to deal with it. And I respect him a lot for it. And they, you know, against Virginia with that style, you can get away with it because it's not like you're going to have Virginia attacking the rim where they could really get you into some serious foul trouble early. And that's why I think VCU can survive with these rules, that they're not going to be playing a lot of dynamic teams.
I think there's a big difference, too, because I think, you know, for a lot of teams – like Pittsburgh, you know, there's kind of a point of diminishing returns with playing that aggressive style because you're going to get called for fouls, but there's not a lot of upside to doing it. Whereas I think with somebody like VCU, that aggressive style, when it's not being called, is creating turnovers. So I think for them, it's good to bear down and just stick with what's working for them. Because, yeah, they're going to get whistled for more fouls, but they're also going to create a lot of turnovers. So I think for a Louisville or a VCU, it's worth it to dig in and still play your style of ball.
Yeah.
David, I'm going to switch you to a different game because we do need to move on a little bit here. But Xavier, Tennessee, two teams that have been mentioned in tournament conversations, this game by four. Did we learn much about either of these squads?
Well, I mean, I think we learned that Xavier is a little bit better than we probably thought, and I don't know if they're a tournament team. I mean, you know, it was a home game for them, but for a team that missed the NIT last year and that had no real buzz about them at any point last year and had no electricity or momentum around them this year, to get a win like that at home over Tennessee, who I think is a tournament team, I think it was almost more important off paper for them than what it was on paper. I mean, they're not the doormats of the Big East. They're not one of the lower three. I think that if they can beat Tennessee at home, they can at least beat most of the Big East at home. And I think we're going to see them in the discussion at the end of the year. I went from not being sure to thinking that, at worst, they're a fringe tournament team now.
All right. I'm going to jump back to Chad real quick. Let me ask you about another game. UMass knocks off LSU 92-90. Somewhat of a surprise. Maybe not too much of a surprise because this game was in Massachusetts. But, I mean, do you see UMass at this point as being a team that's going to contend for a tournament bid at the end of the season? Are you a little more sold on them now?
I'm still not sold on this UMass team now. I don't think that this is going to be a tournament team. I was very disappointed in LSU, and I think not only from the way they played, but I think the way the game was coached. I think there were some critical errors in coaching, and time management was absolutely awful in this game.
Who's coaching them now? I can't even remember.
Oh,
wait, I got it.
Johnny Jones.
From North Texas.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same kind of coaching that led to such great results at North Texas the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Expectation. I mean, I got it. Sorry, Chad, to jump in. To say this was bad coaching implies a level of coaching that wasn't bad. there were some alley-oop attempts that were misguided, I would say. Chad, your thoughts on Johnny Jones' interpretation of the idea of using it or losing it with the timeout at the end of the first half?
Absolutely, and that was one of my key points. As I was watching the game, I just saw this here. With 6 seconds left and a timeout still in pocket, UMass scores a point. And you have a timeout that you're going to lose at the half anyhow. You can call a timeout. You can set up a play with 6 seconds and maybe get a decent shot off. Instead, you let the ball bounce around under the basket. 3 seconds goes off there, and you put up a half-court heave at the buzzer, all for a time to save a timeout that you're going to lose anyhow. I did not understand it. As soon as it happened, I saw an email from me saying, what's going on here? They're going to lose this game by a point, and sure enough, they did. They lost it by two points.
I think I can explain this. I actually think I can explain this.
Oh, okay.
It was stupid.
I thought for certain the bottle of Beam was coming out when you said I can explain this. But
if I can give a quick thought on UMass, and I'm going to hate everything I say in the next 60 seconds on a personal level, but I have to be honest here. I mean, UMass is a good start to the season for them. They got a win over a pretty comfortable win over a BC team that I clearly was wrong about, which is great. And LSU, I didn't think much of LSU. I actually expected UMass to win. This is a game they should win. I mean, LSU's not very good, and the coaching is clearly worse than I thought it would be. But UMass, I mean, they've played well in these two games. They haven't looked – they've been world beaters. But at the – you know, they had a game – they really should have won this game by double digits. I turned the game off when LSU was down 8 with 2 minutes to go because I didn't think LSU had a chance of making 2 points the rest of the way, let alone 8. But there were a couple of possessions where LSU just really killed themselves. They had a missed transition layup with about 4 minutes to go. And the possession at the end of the first half. But this really was not as close of a game as the score indicates. UMass really was in control pretty much throughout as the first half wore on. It was a very high-scoring final 10 minutes of the first half. There were a combined 67 points. And that's the thing where I think UMass could thrive with the rules because they've got Chaz Williams and Samson Carter going up and down the court attacking the lane aggressively. The two of them shot a combined 29 free throws. And thankfully for UMass, they shot 70% as a team, whereas LSU shot just 15 of 25 at the line. But for UMass, this is two good wins to start the season, beating BC and LSU. And those are two teams that aren't very good, possibly, but they will play teams that are. And all it takes is BC with Olivier Hanlon to pull an upset over a team like North Carolina or, Virginia. And then their rating goes up, and that will help out. You know, rising tide lifts all boats, and you'll be surprised at how high UMass is in the KenPom rankings this year just by UMass, virtue of those two wins.
They're already top 40.
Yeah, they were slated to play
really
Harvard.
Hard for them to fall. It's going to be really hard for them to fall below 75 this year in the ratings, I really think, just with the way their schedule is. Now, if they do, we won't have to talk about them very long because they'll have to lose a lot of games.
Yeah. Yeah, but they were slated to play Harvard, who was better than LSU. But
right. I mean, looking at they play BYU, they play Nebraska, they play Florida State, they play Providence, and then they've got the A-10 schedule. UMass plays enough teams that aren't shitty where they should be okay. They do Northern Illinois, and that one could be a problem.
We got to get to our look forward part of the podcast. But, Kyle, real quick, a couple other results from the last couple of days. BYU knocks off Stanford in Palo Alto, 112-103. Richmond defeats Belmont by 8. You had a couple other games from yesterday of note, including Cal just destroying Denver. They win that game by 27. Cincinnati beats North Carolina State by 11. Any of those outcomes or any other outcomes that I missed surprising to you?
I'm actually a little, with all the hype coming in on Cal coming into the year, I'm actually surprised they blew out Denver the way they did. I mean, I wasn't going with the trendy upset pick that like everybody else was, but I had my reservations about Cal, and I was actually surprised that California, came out and throttled Denver the way they did. That was really impressive, and it was much needed for the Pac-12 because they've been kind of hit or miss so far. And while you mentioned BYU, I do want to give a little shout-out now with Penn State's loss earlier this evening to Bucknell. The West Coast Conference is now the only undefeated conference left in college basketball. So a big midweek shout-out to the West Coast Conference.
Woo-hoo! Yeah, let's give them a round of applause.
They do have a game going on still tonight, but one of the games we didn't mention, Galen, that Florida-Wisconsin game.
Yes, thank you. Go ahead, if you want to talk about that.
Actually, with their suspensions, Florida did not look good in their opening game against North Florida. It was until the second half that they really pulled away in that game. And the fact that it was only a 6-point game here and they were able to hang in there against Wisconsin not only surprised me, but I think may show that Wisconsin's going to have a little bit of trouble this year.
I mean, I watched a lot of this game. I was actually really impressed with the way that Wisconsin answered the initial surge by Florida. Florida was up by 10 or 12 points within the first, I think, 9 minutes of the game. And Wisconsin, in the last half of the first half, went on a 19-8 spurt. And they really kind of just seized control at that point and didn't look back. Will Yeget had a wonderful game. I mean, even though he only scored 8 points. He was, every time he went up offensively, he did something with it. He didn't turn the ball over. He just needed to do that more. And, what killed them, I think, was Prather just eating possessions and to no huge effect, I think, for Florida. Wisconsin, it's obviously going to be a different sort of team. It's a smaller team than we're used to with this Wisconsin squad. I mean, that, you know, when you've got Gosser out there and you've got Brust out there and you've got Trevon Jackson, I mean, that's three guys who are 6'3 or shorter, and that's going to give them a little bit of an issue, I think, in the Big Ten. But but at home, especially against this Florida team that's obviously shorthanded, it was going to be a situation where I think their ball control and their ability to play defense was going to be very useful. And surprisingly in this game, guys, only two players fouled out, and only one of those players belonged to Wisconsin. So,
yeah. I mean, in Wisconsin, it was nice to see them actually shoot 23s and make nine of them, because they're built to be a three-point shooting team, but that's, you know, they're built like a run-and-gun team, but good luck getting them to get that. And if Florida wants to leap to the next level, even when they get everyone back, they've got to get more out of Casey Hill. I mean, they need some sort of outside threat, and he was pretty brutal last night. Gail, real quick before we move on, you mentioned BYU-Stanford.
Yeah.
Stanford.
Are you gonna start firejohnnydawkins.com?
I mean, do I need to? It's not already up. I mean, the lack of attempt to defend the inside was almost as bad as their perimeter defense. They're just brutal. It was embarrassing how bad they were on the inside. I mean, the rebounds are very misleading on this game, because from the stats, it may look even, but it was not. Stanford was completely soft on the inside, and then BYU just made every shot they wanted to.
I'd like to note
Matt Carlino being.
Hold on. I want to note something. FireJohnnyDawkins.com is available, as you can see here on your screen, folks. So,
Get it to the Hoops HD network.
Yeah, get your wallets out. You were about to mention Matt Carlino, Lee. Go ahead.
He had the worst offensive game other than Luke Worthington. He only had a 99 offensive rating. Collinsworth 111, Hawes 135, Austin 163, Micah 128, Bartley 131, and Winder 209. 209. He only took five field goals, and his offensive rating was 209. BYU, I might have to completely revise my thoughts. They looked amazing, but man, was Stanford. There wasn't a lot of effort, and it was the second game of the year. Something's up there. This Johnny Dawkins situation might unravel pretty quick. It doesn't look good.
The defense needs a little bit of work.
But... yeah, no, I mean, here's the thing. BYU took their foot off the gas to end up at 112. I mean, they were at 100 with, what, like 6 or 7 minutes to go? It was embarrassing.
I hope Stanford
does a Stanford game, because he will go off. It'll be great.
Go ahead, David. Finish up.
Well, great Bill Walton doing a Stanford game. It would be,
it's going to be great.
I got nothing.
I can't wait.
I completely lost my train of thought.
It's okay. Don't worry about it. Anyway, so let's move forward. We got about 15, 16 minutes left in today's show. And if you got questions, folks, you can comment on the YouTube channel that you're watching. We'll actually be able to put the comments up on the screen while they come across. So we welcome you doing that. You can also tweet us at HoopsHD if you've got any questions. So let's look at some of the games we've got coming up throughout the course of the next few days. So tomorrow, you're not dealing with the greatest of games. There are some decent ones, though. So we've got Arizona at San Diego State, which I think
that's a good one.
Could be of some interest. You've got Detroit at UConn, and we'll get Lee's thoughts on that in just a second. You've got Texas Southern at Miami. Now, this is going to be interesting on a number of levels, because Miami should be 0-2 at this point, Chad, but somehow they haven't. But, I mean, could they possibly lose this Texas Southern game, given the way they're playing?
More than possibly.
This is a big danger game for them, and this is, you know, could be the game we're talking about in Texas Southern when we determine whether they get the play-in game or the number 16 seed come tournament time, too. So.
David, do you have a pick in this game?
Texas Southern.
You're picking Texas Southern. Man,
I think so, yeah.
Tough season so far for Larranaga. It's unfortunate. We've also got Northwestern Stanford. Kyle, I'm really curious. Is this a
parental block to make sure I don't even accidentally turn that game on.
Surely this is a win for Stanford, right, Kyle?
Yeah, it's got to be. If not, then they're in worse shape than we thought. This is Yeah, this should be one of the easier wins on their non-conference schedule they have, or one of the easier wins on their whole schedule they have.
Yeah.
Now, I know Eastern Illinois isn't very good, but Northwestern did play very well in that game. I was so disappointed in Stanford, I would not be shocked if Northwestern registers the first big win for them now, under the Chris Collins era.
Oh, come on, Todd Bearsman. Let's get a grip here. BYU was, by some people's measure, the preseason favorite to win the West Coast.
That's true.
Only undefeated conference left in college basketball, mind you.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's keep in mind that Stanford lost to a pretty good team.
And that Northwestern is not a pretty good team.
That's true. I know. I just want to see how they try and stop Alex Ola and Sobolewski inside. It shouldn't be hard, or not Sobolewski inside, but just Ola. I think Ola will go for 20-10, even if they
We need to get off this game.
I will say this. One thing that, I mean, if you're – it all depends on how good you think Bucknell is, because you know it lost in the Stanford loss to BYU is the fact that they almost lost to Bucknell a couple of nights earlier, and you know yes Bucknell
Penn
State just
is saying, hell yes Bucknell is a tough team
yeah they exactly are. Yeah but I don't know if they're necessarily better than Northwestern. It's just a game to watch, obviously. Anyway, I wanted to go back.
That would be the Bucknell that tonight did win at Penn State, I believe.
Yeah, but it's Penn State.
The person who
it's
just
Penn
typed
State.
Up Bucknell has said very nice things about this Penn State team, and I would like to invite Kyle to back off of those now.
I said just as many nice things about Penn State. I apologize for that. But Lee,
I already jumped onto the Nebraska bandwagon. So
he
I'm
did.
Done with
Fair
Penn
enough. He's, I with, tried. I tried in the preseason. It wasn't based on much, but I might have hit something there.
With both feet, he jumped on that Nebraska bandwagon. I was trying to cool him off a little bit. Yeah, it was very empty. It had plenty of landing space. Lee, Detroit, UConn. No more Ray McCallum Jr. Are you worried at all about this game for UConn?
It's not a favorite. The last non-conference team to win at Gamble Pavilion are the Detroit Titans in the 2001 NIT.
Really?
Yes. They would show highlights tomorrow night, but the game was not televised. So, that was the last team to win at Gamble Pavilion. UConn had this really inconsistent Caron Butler guy, and it didn't look like the program was going anywhere.
Wow.
Now the Titans come into Gamble Pavilion, and I'll tell you, UConn... they haven't really played great in the first two games. I mean, they in both games against Maryland and against Yale, they should have blown out Yale more convincingly than they did. In both games, they had a 15-point lead with about 10 minutes to go, and just they turned off. And they out-rebounded Maryland, and so that was the good sign. But against Yale, they got absolutely destroyed. They had one second chance point to, I believe, 22 for Yale. They got out-rebounded by Yale. DeAndre Daniels might have played in both games. You could have fooled me. He had no points against Yale, and that's really the key here. I think they should win comfortably tomorrow night against Detroit, but as Indiana has taught us this year, anything's possible. This has got to be a game where they've got to dominate inside. They've got to show some signs. I mean, Detroit, they've got Juwan Howard, not the Juwan Howard I'm sure that Ray McCallum misses.
There's a different Juwan Howard, right?
Yeah, but this is a team that they've got Howard, Brunsma, and Njoku, three really big guys, and they'll get token contributions out of Onwuegbu, who I don't believe is related to Onwuegbu Onwuegbu, but Onwuegbu Onwuegbu played soccer like he was a post player in the Horizon League. So this is a team that's got some size in Detroit, and I mean, Howard's a really good rebounder, and that's the one thing I'm paying attention to tomorrow night, is can DeAndre Daniels show the form that he had late in the year last season when he was a double-double machine pretty much. And if they can get something out of Kent Facey, who was the New York City Player of the Year, they struggled getting him eligible for a while, hasn't shown anything in the first two games, hasn't played much. And Omida Bryan has been really good at blocking the basketball. Rebounding, it's another thing entirely. They've got to get something out of the front court, especially when basically at this point the season for UConn is kind of building towards Madison Square Garden, but maybe even more so now building towards the Florida game with how the other three teams at the Garden have played. But that's what tomorrow night. I don't think Detroit has a chance in the game, but UConn's got to win the rebounding battle against Detroit if they want people to take them seriously.
Fair enough. I wanted to say before we moved on to Friday, I really, really enjoy the camera work on the Pac-12 network. And for those who were watching about a minute ago, you know what I'm talking about.
It has to be really creative because you want to show fans. And
all four of them in that side of the stands. I'm going to just declare right away, don't watch basketball on Friday. Just go do something else. I think the only game of note seems to be Georgia Tech.
Oh, come on. How can you not watch that?
I don't think either fan base is aware that game is on Friday at this stage.
Or that they play basketball.
Or that's what I meant,
As the czar of bad basketball, I would like to fully endorse 2.5 hours of your time for Georgia Tech, Georgia. I would also like to endorse the same amount of time for the Simbular show against Tim Floyd at UTEP at New Mexico State.
Yeah.
Oakland at Cal.
Creighton is 8 St. Joe's. And don't forget, North Dakota State, St. Mary's tomorrow night.
Oakland at Cal has the distinct scent of bad Pac-12 loss possibility. Man. It would not completely stun me to see that happen. By the way, Rhode Island's got to be careful at home against NCAA&T because they got waxed at SMU. I'm really interested to see how this team responds against a bad team.
I'm sorry, when we start bringing MEAC teams into the discussion, we know we need to get off the
move
day.
Move it on.
Move forward. Chad, on Saturday, we got Minnesota at Richmond. Richmond had a nice win earlier against Belmont. I mean, this is another team that we've talked about kind of in the mix from a tournament perspective, and they play a Minnesota team that I don't think we know anything about at this stage. Your thoughts on that and maybe another game on Saturday, maybe Virginia-Davidson.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to that Minnesota-Richmond. I think that may be the best game on the slate here for Saturday. This probably being our weakest Saturday of the season just before we get into the tournaments.
You're forgetting Ohio State's debut on Fox Sports 2, but that's we'll get back to that.
Well, yeah.
Give me a second. Ha! All right, go ahead.
Actually, Ohio State at Marquette is actually on Fox. It's not on Fox Sports 2.
It's on Fox Sports 1.
It's on Fox.
It's on regular Fox. Wow, they're moving up in the world.
Yeah, it's the lead into whatever football game they have on that afternoon. There's a few other games there, though, on the slate. Weber State's at Colorado State. I think this Weber State team's a pretty good team here. VCU is hosting Winthrop, who's always been a...
Answer the question. We want to hear about Minnesota-Richmond.
Minnesota-Richmond, I think Richmond wins the game. I think Minnesota just isn't quite ready yet.
All right.
I think Richmond wins the game, and it's not even a quality win at the end of the year.
I'm not going to spend time on this, but I will say Minnesota, for whatever it's worth, did look great against Montana. That may not mean anything, but I'm just saying they did look good.
I don't think it means anything. But I
got one real quick. That's kind of in the low major conference. Well, not low major, but George Washington travels to Manhattan. George Washington, the third year under Mike Lonergan, it's a lot of pressure on him this year. They've looked really good in their first two games. They've also played Radford and Maine. Meanwhile, Manhattan, a team that a lot of folks were counting on to make a big step in the MAC, they have not looked good at all in their first two games. They needed two T's to beat LaSalle, that's a good result, but they barely beat Columbia. They escaped against Columbia by one. They got a home game against an A-10 team. This is a big spot for Manhattan. I think it's going to be a very close game, but I think George Washington's a better team at this point.
David, hold on. I wanted to get over to David on this. So we've also got on that day Utah State at UC Santa Barbara, which is interesting in light now of UC Santa Barbara having thwacked UNLV on the road.
This is interesting for all kinds of reasons. UC Santa Barbara went into Vegas and I don't know what the final score ended up being. I turned it off when it was, I think, at 25-27.
It was 86-65 was the final, and.
Yeah, and this is a UNLV team that is good and tough to beat at home. Now, I am still chalking it up to a fluke. I don't think Santa Barbara is as good as that, although they're probably going to be a power in the Big West. But here's a game for Utah State who can't get anybody to play them. It's just a shame they didn't know that Santa Barbara was going to be this good because they could have scheduled somebody else and then complained about how they can't get anybody to play them.
Well, you know, the best laid plans, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, a game that would have been great 3 years ago, Weber State at Colorado State. That,
yeah,
it's not hard to get into it this year.
No.
But I'm still going to pay attention to it. It's just a shame this game didn't happen 2 years ago.
I want to jump over to Kyle because we haven't talked to Ohio State and Marquette. Marquette looked pretty good. Granted, they were beating Grambling, yesterday, I think it was. But Ohio State, good game against Ohio, kind of let their foot off the gas at the end. Your thoughts on this contest? I mean, it's a road game for Ohio State. It's a relatively tough opponent. What are you seeing out of this one?
Yeah, I mean, this is the game that should have happened last year. It's just disappointing we're getting it a year late. This is going to be a great game, I think. Marquette
won't be rained out.
Yeah,
they have a contingency plan if it's raining.
I mean, there's no aircraft carriers in Lake Michigan that they're going to play this on.
I can't imagine there's going to be condensation at the Bradley Center, but if there is, then we've got big problems.
Could be spilled beer at the Bradley Center, but
they're going to play it on the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Oh,
that's it for me. Good night, everybody.
That was good. That's why we have you here. Wow. Kyle, please, go ahead.
I don't even know what I was going to say now.
That's it.
No, it'll be an interesting game because I think if the game against Grambling was any occasion, it does look like Marquette wants to push the ball this year. And I think that Ohio State, although they don't like to push it as much as Marquette, I think that it's a style they're willing to play. So we could see a game, especially if it's called the way it was, the way it's been in college basketball, we could see a game here in the 70s or 80s quite possibly. I have a feeling this is going to be a very entertaining game, though.
Yeah, should be quite interesting. And let's move on to the Sunday games as we're almost out of time.
Just one more quick interesting game.
Chad, yeah. Go ahead.
Interesting game, at least on Saturday. Seton Hall has a true road game at Mercer, which is interesting scheduling quirk there.
Mercer's a frightening little team. I mean, you look at what they – I mean, they lost to Texas, but they barely lost to Texas.
They blew it.
Granted, they lost to Texas being used as a legitimate strike against
Well,
them.
I mean,
my God.
This is,
How
this
bad
is, the
is
world.
Texas?
This is
they
the world
lost
we live
to a
in.
Team that they should have beaten.
Yes. Well, and look, Mercer, for those who've forgotten last year, Mercer was, I think, the regular season champion in the Atlantic Sun.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
And they lost to Gulf Coast in the championship game. But they were
beat
in the
Tennessee in the NIT.
They beat Tennessee in the NIT. They lost to BYU. I mean, it's a good team. I've been toying with the idea of going to Evansville because they're playing Evansville, I think, next week or the week after, but I don't know if I really want to do that. But anyway.
Well, moving on to Sunday, Galen, because I want to put this on you. Let's talk about Stony Brook at Indiana.
Let's talk about that game. I'm quite curious. Of course, Indiana, for those who missed it, beat LIU by a point. And it's been interesting, the phenomenon here in Hoosier country, because everybody's decided that LIU is now the odds-on favorite to win the Northeast Conference and that they're a really good team. That's my reaction, David, but other people don't seem to agree.
Oh,
yeah.
Good.
David's starting another Sharknado here on the podcast. But no, I mean, I think Indiana, they obviously struggled a lot more against LIU than you would have hoped, and particularly more than they did against Chicago State. They didn't struggle in that game at all. But they've got Samford on Friday, and then they play Stony Brook. And Stony Brook's a tough team. I mean, this is a team that is probably going to give them some issues. And, you know, right now, and obviously these ratings are going to change pretty regularly, but right now KenPom's got Indiana 42 and Stony Brook 72. So this is a closer contest than I think people who are maybe not as well informed about what's going on in college basketball as a whole might expect. What do you think you're going to see out of this game? Anybody chime in on this?
I think Indiana adjusts. I really just think they had a bad game against. NI makes it like LIU Brooklyn. I don't think they're as good as Wagner, but they are one of the better teams in the Northeast Conference. They're not a bad team, and Indiana had a bad game against them, but they still got the win. I think they have a better game against Stony Brook and get it done.
Yeah,
it's Stony Brook.
My only thing, hold on, I'll get to you in a second, Kyle. My only thing is this, Peter. LIU Brooklyn lost their top five leading scorers from last year.
Yes, but they have their sixth leading scorer back.
Well, in the end, I mean that is a good point. But hey, all these people saying, well, Indiana's young, they're inexperienced. So was LIU Brooklyn. That's the thing that people seem to be missing in this equation. It wasn't like it was, oh, Indiana was inexperienced, and you had this plucky underdog that came in and was experienced and was able to use that to almost pick up a victory. I mean, all things being equal, this shouldn't have been nearly as close as it was. What were you going to say, Kyle?
I was just going to point out that in the context of talking about a Tom Crean coach team, he used the word adjust.
Moving on.
Jackson, the Jackson-Coley backcourt should concern you a bit, Gale, and they're good. But outside of that, I mean, Stony Brook beat Marist by 16, and that, to me, raises more of a red flag than anything else. I mean, because Marist is awful. I don't think this needs to be a – Stony Brook's a good team, but I expect Indiana to be able to pull this out as long as Yogi Ferrell can match up against Anthony Jackson. And I think that's a reasonable expectation, I would hope. But outside of the backcourt, even IU should be able to dominate inside against Stony Brook. IU.
We thought that against LIU too, and they didn't. So who knows? We'll see. Should be at least an entertaining game, which is more than what people thought it would be at the beginning of the year. Other games going on. Chad, Denver back in action, and guess who they're playing? They're playing Stanford at home.
They got Stanford. Although I really think I'm going to be spending Sunday watching Oregon State and Maryland.
Oh. Here's the question. If Oregon State loses big, do they just leave Craig Robinson in Maryland at that stage?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know that they're going to lose big. Maryland struggled for 25 minutes with Abilene Christian tonight. Their second game ever as a D1 team, and it wasn't until about midway through the second half. So I don't think this Maryland team is much of anything either. Now, but going back to the Stanford-Denver game at Denver, interestingly enough, and I think Stanford's in trouble. I really like this Denver team this year.
All right.
By the way, worth mentioning, give them credit. Abilene Christian, outside of their first 10 minutes in Division I, when they got torched by Duquesne, they played very well the last 30 minutes there, played very well tonight. But I do wonder if after Oregon State got Fang Mitchell, did the President of the United States suddenly decide to let his brother-in-law know that he had like a trade agreement meeting or something on Sunday, and that he wasn't going to be able to make it to the Comcast Center because it's just bad as a coach right now.
They did beat Portland tonight by 3 points. So.
Yeah, by 3 points.
Awesome. Oh, so the West Coast Conference is no longer undefeated.
Yeah, that is the first loss by the West Coast Conference.
That's a shame. David, let me stick with you real quick. We've got Indiana State at Notre Dame. This could be an intriguing contest because Indiana State maybe the best or second best team in the Missouri Valley right now.
Yeah, that doesn't put them in the same neighborhood as Notre Dame, I don't think. But yeah, outside of Wichita State, I do think Indiana State is the best team. But I think they're kind of in over their head. In order for them to win this, they'll have to play really well, and Notre Dame will have to play down. Being the second-best team in the Missouri Valley this year, I don't think that warrants a tournament team. I mean, it might be NIT at best. I just don't think they can go on the road and win.
No, that's fair enough.
So be sure and tune in. I just gave that team a big
that's what they hire you to do, all the promotional materials for these
things. I am a little interested in South Carolina Clemson because I thought South Carolina played pretty well at Baylor. And they crushed Longwood like you would hope they would if they're going to make any sort of progress.
And we get
into the Frank Martin era. He's got the anger back, which is a good sign. And Clemson sucks.
Yes.
So I think if Frank Martin really wants to show progress, they'll win this game. And then, I don't know, maybe South Carolina? A sleeper SEC team?
No. Kyle,
they look good though at Baylor. I was impressed.
Kyle, we're gonna close things out. Let me finish with you. Iowa State hosting Michigan. This is an interesting contest. Iowa State obviously has some talent, and Michigan, you know, some people pick them to win the Big Ten. They supposedly have a consensus, or not a consensus, but a near consensus All-American. on their roster, although I think allegedly is probably the better way of putting that. What do you think about this game at this stage?
You know, I actually have not been very impressed with Iowa State thus far, but the irony is Michigan has played well. The first half against
UMass. Wait, hold on. What haven't you been impressed with Iowa State about? I mean, they've won both games by like 30 points each.
Yeah, but
unimpressive 30.
Well, I mean, granted, yes, they're playing.
I changed the channel. I was unimpressed with how boring the game was.
A&M Corpus Christi. I mean, those were their two games, but still. Anyway. Go, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
In fairness, I didn't see their most recent game, but I didn't even see their whole first game. But the thing about Michigan, what's interesting to me is the last game and a half, really. That they've played well, but they've really been doing it. Like, Glenn Robinson has not been. I mean, everybody expected him to be the All-American, but it's actually Caris LeVerth that stepped up and looks out to be like he's playing like the breakout player for them right now, which would be interesting because if LeVerth, you know, continues to play this well, maybe they'll live up to that ranking. But this will be an interesting test for Michigan early on to see if they're, you know, if they're in fact a top 10 team yet or if they're still a work in progress.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a game, obviously, that if Michigan's going to be a serious top 10 team throughout the course of the year, they need to win, I think. But on the flip side, I mean, it's a game that Iowa State needs to take advantage of. I mean, they've got basically only three games of note in their non-conference, at least three games that they're guaranteed of in their non-conference. They got this game. They got to travel to BYU next Wednesday. That'll be an interesting game. And then they have Iowa at home on the 13th as part of the Cy-Hawk, whatever the hell they've got. Anyway, that's going to wrap it up for us pretty much. But before we go, guys, let me just get a quick answer from you. Most impressive thing you've seen so far in this first week of college basketball. Chad, let me start with you.
I think the most impressive thing I've seen is Kansas's team outright. I think they really showed me a lot more than I even expected coming into the season.
All right. Lee.
Well, I was going to say Kansas, so I use this opportunity to give a shout-out to it really might be New Hampshire winning at Duquesne. That is a stunning result for me. But other than that, I think it's that last night we got an event where really everything you could want happened, where everyone was paying attention to college basketball early in the season. The crowd was into it, and I thought the freshmen, maybe a lot of shots, but I was so impressed with Parker and Wiggins. And I guess, or the fact that the Pac-12 has provided me another season of embarrassing out-of-conference losses on the Pac-12 network. I mean, this is consistency that you really wish we could get from other conferences.
I agree completely, and I think the SEC will provide that to us.
Yeah,
and that
go
may
Cotton
be the only
State. How about the Fighting Fangs winning at Oregon State?
That's all right. Kyle, your most impressive thing of the season so far.
Yeah, you mentioned the SEC. I think the most impressive thing is the SEC and how unimpressive they've been. I think they're 0-6 in meaningful games so far. They've lost every halfway competitive game they've played. They've lost it. It doesn't bode well for them. I wasn't expecting big things from the SEC this year, but they've even not even met my expectations. Not saying a lot because they were low to begin with.
David.
Well, I mean, Kansas is, I think, the team that's impressed me the most, especially, I caught a little bit of them in their first game against Monroe, or Louisiana Monroe, I guess, and they just looked so much better. It was such a well-played game against a Duke team that blew not a good but a decent Davidson's team's doors completely off. So to see them go into Chicago and win the way they did in a really well-played game was impressive. The biggest surprise you mentioned it earlier, Santa Barbara. I just cannot believe that. It was just flat out stupid what they did at UNLV.
All right. My most impressive thing is actually college basketball wide. Kyle and I were talking about this last night. The offensive efficiency for the top part of college basketball has declined a little bit. But the most impressive thing is the efficiency for the bottom part of college basketball has actually increased significantly from last year. So you're seeing more scoring from the worst teams offensively, which is a good sign. And that may be the biggest positive that we've gotten so far out of the new officiating rules. So
I guess the one fear we had was that with all the fouls, it would make bad teams on offense look worse. But it seems to have
Yeah, I mean, it's a small sample size so far, but it's promising, I think, for those of you who like offense, and I'm one of those people. Anyway, for Chad Sherwood, for David Griggs, for Kyle Lamb, for Lee Delvecchio, and Todd Beresman, I'm Galen Clavio. Thanks for joining us on the midweek show. Promise we'll have a better name in the future. We'll catch you folks on
the
flip side.
Under the radar tomorrow.
Under the radar, maybe. Yes, Under the Radar podcast is tomorrow. I forgot about that. But be sure to tune into Hoops HD on that. Bracket Racket Sunday night. Tune in for that as well. Catch you folks on the flip side. So long, everybody.